Both our presidential candidates and their policy team seem to be suffering from a bad case of economic illiteracy in somewhat different ways, or maybe not so different. With two aspiring leaders both saying that they want to make things better for middle-class and lower-income Americans, it's pretty discouraging to see them advance economic policies that would actually make everybody worse off. Let's talk about it. Hello, everybody. I'm Graham Walker, coming to you today from the Independent Institute in Oakland, California. And welcome to Independent Outlook, where we try to offer an independent take on the issues of the day. As always, I am joined by my colleague, Philip Magnus, holder of the David J. Thoreau Chair in Political Economy. Welcome, Phil. And also joined by my perennial conversation partner, Williamson Evers, director of our Center on Educational Excellence and General Polymath. Great to have you, Bill.
Thank you, Graham.
So why are these presidential candidates so muddled on economics? This is obviously going to be equal opportunity criticism, but let's start with Kamala Harris's big economic policy address in North Carolina. She's going to stop price gouging with some kind of system of price controls for food items at the grocery store. Phil, how would this work, and how many commissars will it take to enforce it?
Well, there's the interesting thing is Harris has not gotten too detailed on the specifics of her price gouging scheme, or it's basically an attempt to control inflation by putting a freeze on prices on groceries. But what we do know about it is it's informed by some very fringe elements of the economics discipline. So there was a school of thought that came out of UMass Amherst and the New School. These are very left-wing PhD programs in economics. They're considered heterodox schools, so outside of the mainstream. But about a year and a half, 2 years ago, there was an economist by the name of Isabella Weber who wrote this op-ed basically saying, we need price controls to tame inflation. Now, this is a really bad idea. It's something that we have thousands of years of economic history of attempts to control inflation with price control, and it fails almost every single time. The last major one in the U.S. was during the Nixon administration. He put in a price freeze.
A Republican president, yeah, I would add.
Right before the presidential election in 1972, so about a year before that, he put in a price freeze, and all it did was pushed the inflationary pain until after the election. More recently, we've had catastrophic experiments with price freezing in Nicolas Maduro's Venezuela, which happened against the backdrop of a hyperinflationary regime, and then a similar experiment in Hungary under Viktor Orban about a year and a half ago. We imposed price controls at the grocery store trying to stem inflation that was going on in Hungary, and it ended up exacerbating it and making Hungary one of the worst inflationary economies in all of Europe. So we have a clear track record. It just doesn't work.
Phil, 40 centuries of evidence is not enough.
Exactly. Exactly.
I mean, when Emperor Diocletian, around 300 AD, when he wasn't spending his time persecuting Christians, he was handing out edicts on price control with the death penalty.
Good grief. I mean, the very simple aspect of why that's a problem, if I understand this correctly, is that if you impose governmentally coercive price controls, it eliminates or reduces incentives to produce the things that people want, which means that there'll be less of them, which means that there'll be a scarcity, which means there'll be lines like there were in the Soviet Union, and everyone's worse off.
It's obliterating the mechanism of pricing as a signal. Because, you know, we see at the grocery store when a good is in very, very high demand, people are consuming it, the shelves start to empty out, and the grocery stores will adjust their prices, realizing, hey, this is a popular product. But that's also a signal to also replenish their inventory.
Exactly.
And you take that away from them, there's no mechanism to do it anymore.
And for producers to try and fill up that inventory.
And
they're going to also, you know, it's going to lead to these distortions. It's going to lead to people selling things on the sly in a black market at the market price and not at the controlled price.
And there's the question.
It was denounced by the editorial board of the Washington Post.
Oh, exactly.
Plus, they followed up by publishing a scathing op-ed piece. So this is not receiving acclaim of any sort.
Yeah, even
Jason
the center
Foreman,
left. is denouncing
Jason Furman, the head of the Council of Economic Advisers under Obama, he said, you know, there's no real upside and there's plenty of downside.
What I don't understand is exactly what mechanism is, in an imaginative sense, going to be used to coercively enforce
it. I think they're going to use the Federal Trade Commission, and they're going to look at profits and stuff like that. And of course, it's ridiculous because the grocery industry has some of the slenderest margins of any industry in the country.
Right.
So it's rhetoric. We did something. But they hope that they've done something dramatic. Nixon, it was the same with Nixon. And it's not that the people in the Harris administration don't know that this is not going to work. They actually know it. Or, I mean, I don't know, some of them, like these fringe people that Phil is talking about, may not. But anyway, plenty of people around Harris and around the White House today know this is not going to work. But they want to do something that punches through to the public, that public is discontented at the high price of groceries. So this is their thing, and they're counting on the public not to remember Nixon and not to remember price controls on energy during the Nixon administration and not to really know the sophisticated aspects of what price controls effects are going to be. They'll see it pretty soon if it ever gets enacted, but for now, I'm going to get elected, then we'll deal with the problem.
If there were a regime of price controls of this type, I'm sure that various industry groups would lobby for special exceptions, and they would bring political pressure to bear and bring extra money into the politics to get their special exceptions so that they wouldn't be under the coercive. I mean, that invites a whole bunch of cronyistic manipulation, doesn't it, Phil?
Well, you see this at the grocery stores. The firms that are going to be least affected by a price control scheme nationally are going to be the large multi-store chains. The Krogers of the world are basically, they have some slack to absorb some of the negative adverse effects of price controls. Whereas the local grocery store that only has like one or two shops, you know, they're operating on a much tighter margin usually. And this is going to be probably where the effect is felt the strongest. So you've got a policy that they're proposing that automatically, even within the price-controlled industries, creates winners and losers comparative to each other, and no real thought about how that's going to play out on the Harris side. Again, I think it really does come back to the fact that she is over-reliant on some really fringe economic thinkers. These are the same people that, you know, a year and a half, 2 years ago were responding to the inflationary surge. You know, inflation was going up and they were saying, oh, this is just because the corporation suddenly decided to get greedy. It's corporate greed that's driving inflation, which goes against all that we know about mainstream monetary economics. Monetary economics says it's actually the money supply that's the mechanism here. It's monetary policy that's the mechanism that causes inflation to occur. It's when the Fed either does something wrong or fails to do something in suitable time. And that's what we had 2 years ago. Yet they were saying, no, it's corporate greed. These are people that believe in modern monetary theory, which is this crackpot school of thought on the far left that basically says government can monopolize its money, spend it on anything. There's no real limit other than maybe some tax constraint on it. And they build like a circular loop of controlling the entire economy. These people are just so far outside of the academic and economic mainstream that it's actually comical. Kamala Harris is relying on them, and yet that's what we're seeing.
It's magical monetary
theory. I like that. Comical Kamala.
Comical
it's a little
Kamala.
Bit of a tongue.
Comrade
it's a bit
Kamala
of a tongue twister. Comrade Kamala, yeah.
Well, of course.
It's crazy stuff.
Well, so we've been talking about trying to control prices on food and stuff like gasoline and so forth. Bad idea, clearly. But hey, we're all familiar with rent controls, right? We know rent controls are great. And so she just wants to expand them, what, nationwide and make them federal? Is that the deal with the rent control part?
That's what it seems to be. expand them nationwide, make them federal and rent control, while also heavily subsidizing the demand side of the housing industry. It's confusing.
Well, she also is, so the one point is to back up something Phil said about money supply, corporate greed is the same all the time, just like consumer greed is the same all the time.
Because human nature is the
money,
same.
Right. It's the money supply that's changed here. It's the expansion of the money supply connected to government activity in response to the lockdown. So one bad government activity led to another, which has now led to this. So as far as rent control goes, she's also attacking corporate landlords versus mom and pop landlords. She's attacking algorithm-based rent increases. There's no evidence that corporate landlords are somehow more exacting, or they're all subject to the rental market, which is an open market. There's no evidence that algorithms are causing some sort of problem. This is just reaching again for something to do, trying to mobilize envy, trying to mobilize against things that people don't actually understand, like algorithm controlled rent. And, you know, it may work for her politically, but it's certainly unsound.
Well, it reminds me of President Biden's gambit previously, where he tried his darndest to get comprehensive forgiveness of college student loans. And, you know, it was illegal. And courts blocked most aspects of it.
No, they're not blocked. They are continuing. They are continuing a mile a minute, even though courts, they have another whole plan that they're going to push through before he leaves office, even though the courts have knocked down each previous one. And by the way, not only that, so they're advancing all this money possibly to people who aren't creditworthy to buy first-term houses. And then what are we going to have? Mortgage forgiveness? I mean,
they are
getting, not only are they going to push up the price of new housing, just like tuition grants push up tuition costs.
I was thinking of the parallel there,
Not only are they going to do that, but they're going to have non-creditworthy people going in that should be holding off until they have larger income or better life patterns before they try and invest in a house. And it's the whole thing. You know, neither Trump nor Kamala Harris's campaign are addressing exclusionary zoning that blocks land use rules that block the supply of housing.
Right, that's the
underlying. That is the key thing. It's not tax breaks. It's not special subsidies. You know, yeah, it'd be nice to use some federal land to build houses on. That's a great idea, but good luck getting that through the environmental groups.
It's deflection from their own policy.
That might be your only good idea.
I was thinking the same thing. Right. That's.
But the point is, the real problem are controls on building on housing, potential housing sites. And no, Trump is on record in an op-ed that he wrote with Ben Carson opposing any loosening of single-family dwelling zoning laws. And that is an example of the kind of exclusionary zoning prevents the housing supply from increasing.
And then you have an environmentalist constituency behind Harris that doesn't want anything built anywhere.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Can I just step backwards half a step to make sure I understood one thing? The idea of giving a subsidy for first home purchase or whatever, which is part of her proposals, I think, that she's made.
But
it has a surface appeal, but I think I heard you say, and I think I understand that what that does drives up demand for low-cost housing, which then drives up the prices of low-cost housing, nullifying the benefit of the subsidy. Isn't that right?
That's exactly it. I mean, you have the housing supply is fixed by all these NIMBY policies that both the left and the right seem to gravitate toward for different reasons. And yet she wants to infuse on the demand side $25,000 to purchase a new house. What will happen is effectively that subsidy will pass right through the entire market and just drive housing prices up even further.
Yeah, exactly. Housing will go up by $25,000 or more. Yeah, okay. That's what I thought I understood. There's something, people try and defy sort of the basic workings of economic, you know, phenomena, but you just
doing something just before an election.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. Just like, you know, even though the courts thwarted President Biden on some of the student loan stuff, college students can say, well, at least Joe Biden tried for us. Mm-hmm. And those mean Republican courts, they wouldn't let him do it. But he tried. He tried to give us free money.
Actually, the Republicans haven't said very much about it.
Oh, no, they haven't.
It's really the courts that have resisted.
No,
I'm not saying no Republican has ever said anything. I'm just saying they don't talk about it very much.
There's one other interesting thing that Kamala Harris said in her recent economic talk had to do with a tax credit for newborn children, so that during the first year of your baby's life, you get some nice, like $6,000 a year.
$6,000, right. But the Trump people are competing. They have $5,000.
I was going to say, this is something where they seem to agree, but is that good?
Well, I mean, we're always against taxes. So there's something, but of course, if it distorts things, it's not so good.
Yeah.
I can't get too worked up about this, except that it's weird that you're having competitive bidding over children.
I mean, since J.D. Vance says there aren't enough children being born, so I understand his reasoning there, and there may be something to that.
Yeah, I think, actually, I mean, there's going to be an upcoming issue of the independent review on the birth dearth, mm-hmm. on the problem in demography that a lot of countries don't really have enough people to sustain their economy.
Yeah.
Yes.
And the United States is affected by this, too. Now, we have a lot of immigrants, and so that helps with that. But they may all get deported, depending on what happens.
Right, right. Okay,
I think realistically, Trump is going to, I mean, they'll probably, if they do deportations, they'll concentrate on criminals. But many other people will get swept up in it, too, if it happens.
Right.
Let me just turn the focus back to Trump now on economic policy. There's a lot to say here. Let me start out with something very, very simple, which I think he abandoned already. But at one point a few months ago, he had said, reflecting, I think, some economic illiteracy, that we should just get rid of the income tax and just do tariffs instead of the income tax.
He did say that.
Wow.
He did say that.
How would that work, and is it a good idea?
Well, by the way, the early United States
was affected with it.
Was financed by combination of land sales and a tariff for revenue purposes.
When you say the United
States,
you mean the central government of the United States.
Yes.
Right. That's right.
The original constitutional mechanism.
That's right.
So the income tax doesn't come until Civil War and then later constitutional fights over it and so forth.
So if tariffs to supply what income taxes provide, tariffs would have to go up by what percentage, would you say, Phil?
Oh, it would be difficult to even estimate that, because income taxes were so much more prodigious at raising funding. You know, that's the pernicious element of them as well.
Right.
Because they thought originally, when they abandoned the old TIRA finance system and implemented the income tax, they thought it's going to be like a one-for-one swap. We just moved to a different revenue mechanism. And it turns out so much money was coming in from the income tax, Congress kind of woke up and said, we have a lot more to spend now. And going back to that, you know, I think it's a quaint idea. I would definitely like to reduce the spending of the federal government.
That would be great.
Any realistic chance of going back to a TIRA finance system?
So let's say we can throw out fake numbers, right? 35%, 45% tariff. Well, that's essentially saying no imports into the United States.
Right.
So then you're not going to get the revenue.
Yeah,
right.
You're on the far side of the Laffer curve.
You got a Laffer curve problem. Phil is going to be better at talking about all this than I am, but so that clearly is a problem for this scheme, that it's sort of self-defeating.
Yeah.
But, of course, I completely concur with Phil's point that if we could figure out ways to get the federal government to be spending less, that would be terrific.
So in general,
pinching the revenue is certainly one way.
Yeah, it wouldn't be bad. Although if we got rid of income tax and jacked up tariffs dramatically to compensate, it would eventually eliminate tariff income too, because people would stop buying.
Right, that's what we're
and
just
then,
saying.
So basically, the only people who'd be getting more revenue would be American manufacturers who
right.
used to compete with foreigners, and they would all be happy.
A subsidy to special interests.
And
I think what this highlights is, even though Trump has a lot of rhetoric about tariffs, he doesn't really understand what they do, doesn't understand how they work. And we saw this in several of his recent speeches.
Mm-hmm.
He makes these comments like tariffs are a tax on foreigners. Well, not really. It turns out the incidence transfers back to the domestic economy.
Right.
Through higher prices. Some of it is actually passed through onto domestic manufacturers and exporters in certain industries. But tax incidence is very different from where the statute says it is. And Trump doesn't really understand that. So he's simultaneously advocating for tariffs for protective reasons. But then he also says, well, we can raise revenue out of them. He doesn't understand that these are conflicting goals.
Right.
You can't
right.
have them both at the same time. It's either mm-hmm. one or the other, because they both work in opposite directions of each other.
Mm-hmm.
So incidence means, for our listeners, who the tax falls on. And as Bill is saying, it could be intermediate manufacturers. So you're buying something from abroad that's an ingredient in your manufacturing process, whether it's machinery or a good that is going to be further refined, further elaborated on. And ultimately, it falls on the American consumer, who has to pay higher prices for the good. And it also, if you have selective countries, like Trump wants to have quite a bit higher tariffs on China than the 10 to 20, now talking about 20% across the board in his most recent speech in North Carolina. So if you have 10 to 20, but you have 60% on China, well, that means that what's being built in China is going to be built in Malaysia, Burma, Thailand, whatever. So it's going to be built somewhere, but probably not just transferred automatically to the United States. I mean, we've seen that they had this Biden effort to have chip manufacturing be fostered in the United States, to have a solar thing and so forth. First of all, 40% of the things that they've given money to have not happened. They've been stalled. The capital isn't there, the matching capital, the permits for, environmental problems are not there. They misestimated the world market for the things. Whatever it is, it's typical of central planning. Have this idea, and they're not in touch with reality. They're not in touch with the market. They pick politically favorite people to be bestowed on it, but they're not necessarily competent. So whether it's the Biden people's efforts in this regard or the Trump people's efforts in this regard, they're not going to turn out.
So, Phil, you have been pretty active in recent months trying to counteract some of the pro-tariff policy proposals coming out of the Trump-aligned right, like American Compass, I think, is one of the groups. What's the nature of your dispute with them, and how's it going?
Well, it's surprisingly similar to what's going on the Harris team. Harris rejects mainstream economics on monetary issues, on inflation, and goes to these really fringe, heterodox, modern monetary theory people on the far left. What Trump is doing, he's rejecting mainstream economic analysis of trade and going to these figures on the far right. This is like Orrin Cass of American Compass and Robert Lighthizer, who was his previous administration's U.S. trade representative. These are adherents to something known as the American system school of economic thought. And what's the American system? It is a program of tariffs and industrial policy and similar subsidies that was first proposed in 1824 by Henry Clay.
It was a, Yeah. Henry Clay, senator from Kentucky, said famously alleged to have claimed, I'd rather be right than be president, although I don't ever said it.
Exactly.
And so this was the program, generally, of the Whig Party. And I'm going to say, I'm having a senior moment on the name of the supposed economist they relied on.
It was Henry Charles Carey was the major economist.
Exactly.
And this is a guy that's writing in the 1850s, and he thinks tariffs are the solution to everything. So what they've done is they've resuscitated like this old, defunct, dead, debunked school of economic thought that's existed on the real periphery of American politics, basically
since
100
years. And which, if you looked at any college econ textbook, would not be taken seriously.
Exactly.
And any, whether a supposedly a liberal author or a conservative or a classical liberal author, the economist author, they don't take this seriously. This is crackpot economics.
Exactly. So you got modern monetary theory or the American system. Choose your crackpot.
Yeah, choose your magical thinking.
Yes.
But of course, to be clear, Phil, the reason you reject the resuscitation of the American system ideas of tariffs and so forth is not because it's old, but because it's false.
It doesn't work.
Correct.
So it's the same thing as price controls. We have centuries of evidence price controls don't work. We also know that tariffs don't work. The most famous economic event of the 20th century was the Great Depression. And when that broke out, when the stock market collapsed in 1929, the protectionist faction in Congress thought, hey, we're going to insulate the American economy with tariffs. So there's a mad rush to erect tariff barriers around the U.S. economy. They passed the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act. They were invoking Henry Clay on the floor of Congress saying, this is what we do to counter recessions. It was the stimulus package that Henry C. Carey recommended in response to the panic of 1857. So they tried to replicate it in 1929 and 1930. They passed this measure, and it's one of the most disastrous economic policies in modern history. It causes a
certainly collapse. Exacerbated and prolonged the Depression.
Yes. Yeah.
No doubt.
Absolutely.
And similar behavior in Europe didn't help things either by countries there.
Yeah, tariffs beget tariffs, it seems, in the international sphere, as I have seen over the years. One interesting thing, I don't know if you guys saw this, but in the Wall Street Journal recently, Ro Khanna, the former Democratic congressman from the Silicon Valley area, published this piece where he says, I differ with J.D. Vance on industrial policy. And
right.
He's criticizing Vance for being too much in favor of so-called industrial policy, which is central government coordination of industrial activity. I thought that was pretty fascinating that even he, although his views are a little different from yours, Phil, even he is arguing against the Trump tariff industrial policy approach.
Yeah, well, I mean,
actually, just to add on, Harris has criticized Trump's protectionist policies too protectionist, despite the fact that the Biden people have kept all the import restrictions on China and even added to them.
I mean,
but she has claimed to be a free trader more so than Trump. It's in a way of a piece, I'll let you talk in a second, Phil. But in a way, it's a piece of the supposed claim that we saw from Tim Walz the other day. I'm appealing to old-fashioned libertarian Republicans.
What?
He said in his speech in Nebraska.
I mean,
I'm sorry. You know, go ahead, answer Grant's
I generally don't believe either of them. I kind of see this as a race to the economic bottom where you can pick your poison. Either you've got protectionist crankery on one side or modern monetary theory crankery on the other side, and you're actually having moderate voices in both parties are looking at this and kind of scratching their heads. Like, how did we end up taking policy advice from the outer fringes of the economic profession, both on the far left and the far right? Well, what's going on with mainstream dialogue consensus that we used to have? So you got this race to the bottom, and it's precisely because mainstream economic analysis, whether the free market variety on the right or the Keynesian variety on the left, is being excluded from the conversation in the service of these really fringe ideologies.
It's a shame. I personally of course, I agree with Phil that these are both horrible. And to have the two parties, it's weird because they're rhetorically competing to sound, you know, we're pro-liberty. No, no, we're pro-liberty. But on the other hand, we can give away special privileges faster than the other guy.
Right.
So it's, I personally think destroying money in banking is worse than excluding foreign products and services, but they're both horrible.
Yeah, they're both bad. Okay, here's another subject on which the two candidates seem equally muddled or confused, which is to say crime or criminal justice reform. Seems to me that in previous election rounds, Donald Trump made something of a name for himself on being in favor of sentencing reform, eliminating mandatory penalties for various kinds of lower level crime. He seemed to be big on that kind of thing, but then he's gone silent. And then on the other hand, Kamala Harris seems to be now playing up what she did as a prosecutor. Can you help me navigate this muddle?
Yeah, a little bit. So, you know, one thing was that Jared Kushner and Trump's daughter, Ivanka, were very interested in criminal justice reform. And there was also a group that was quite active at the time. This is during the first Trump administration, called Right on Crime, which still exists. And so this group tries to get better proportionate sentences. It tries to allow for people to show that they rehabilitated themselves. And it's generally trying to go against, you know, there are cycles in this. Biden, famously in the 1990s, was part and parcel of the draconian federal criminal justice penalties of that era. Kamala went through a period when she was attorney general in California, and to some extent when she was attorney general in San Francisco, of cracking down on nonviolent offenders when they perhaps were coming up for review to be let free, you know, so-and-so, is we can put him on parole and get him out of prison. She generally opposed that. She, even though quite, I think it's quite clear she was a drug user herself, she went right in and strenuously prosecuted drug people.
But she didn't inhale.
There we go. I think she did inhale.
The presidential candidates.
You're mixing
her
up. Oh,
I'm getting confused. I'm showing
Clinton.
My age.
Bill Clinton. The most serious thing that she did as a prosecutor that's ugly in my view is in cases where prosecutors did not give proper discovery information about the background of the case to the defendant, and other things, police misconduct, where the attorney general should say, well, okay, we screwed up, defendant, you go free. She wanted to push ahead with those, despite these bad behavior on the part of law enforcement. So I don't, you know, she comes across as certainly blowing with the winds. If there's fear of crime, she's going to be cracking down on crime.
That's exactly.
But so the weird thing is Trump, who used to tout his record, his pardons of people that were over-sentenced or, you know, anyway, pardons. He's dropped that. You don't hear that in the speeches anymore. It's not part of his stump speech. It's not part of his ads.
Yeah.
Harris, mm-hmm. who is trying to also straddle a thing, she's trying to say, I'm a prosecutor and Trump's a criminal. And they're trying to engineer it so that he's sentenced just before the election. And so I'm a prosecutor. I know this type, the criminal type. Trump is this criminal type.
It was a very clever
line. The other hand, the Republicans are painting her as a, you know, lax, latitudinarian prosecutor who wants, you know, criminals roaming the street. I think that's not an accurate portrayal.
Mm-hmm.
On some things, she was not as tough as she, in other words, on bail laws, on letting people out, helping people who had been rioters in Minneapolis in 2020 get out of jail.
She raised funds for them, basically.
Yeah, went on to commit horrible
crimes. That shocked me, yeah. She wanted to raise...
So they have the Republicans have a point on that, that she has been lax there. But I think she was... I think it would be not wrong to call her even an authoritarian prosecutor when she was holding office.
A corrupt prosecutor. I mean, that was
corrupt in what sense?
Well, in the sense that she would manipulate evidence, she would use the rules of basically bringing charges to try to bludgeon people into either pleading guilty by overcharging them. There were also so many examples of petty charges that were clearly abusive. So she was going after parents for truancy. Was the
right? Thing. She wanted to jail parents for truancy.
Wow. Wow.
I wouldn't say that a lot that happened particularly, but that was part of her program that she wanted to do.
Well, to counterbalance that kind of thing
for their children's truancy,
right? Their children's truancy, right? Not their own. But to counterbalance that kind of error requires a certain finesse in making the case, which I don't think Donald Trump seems to be demonstrating these days. And his own record on criminal justice reform, he's gone silent on what was one of his apparent strengths. So I'm not confident that we're going to get clarity out of this subject.
Right, because he has any rhetoric.
When he visits black audiences, I think he does sometimes bring it up, but it's very...
It's muted.
It's muted, right.
Go ahead, Phil.
Yeah, he's basically backed himself into a corner because he's trying to make this case against immigration on the grounds that immigrants are driving some sort of a crime wave, which is a misdiagnosis of the statistics. But nonetheless, it's a powerful rhetorical point he keeps appealing to. And you can't project a massive crime wave that you want to blame on immigration on one hand and at the same time maintain that you're like the candidate of criminal justice reform on the other.
Mm-hmm.
It's tough.
In economic matters, to some degree on crime and other things, both candidates seem to be looking opportunistically for ways that power of the central government can be expanded, enhanced, yes. and redeployed. And of course, the extreme of that in our day is what's going on in Venezuela, where the power of the central government was pushed to a max far beyond what either of our candidates seems to be proposing, thank goodness. I'm worried about what's going on in Venezuela. Maduro apparently lost, but claims he didn't. And there are a lot of people trying to justify or legitimize the Venezuelan dictatorship. You wrote a fascinating piece recently, Phil, on that. Can you tell us what that's about?
Well, this basically goes back to about 25 years of Venezuelan history. If you remember, before Nicolas Maduro, his mentor, the person that put him in office, was this character by the name of Hugo Chavez. Chavez was a Marxist revolutionary who attempted to wage a coup d'etat in the 1990s to seize control of the Venezuelan government. He failed and went to prison for that. But then as soon as he gets out of prison, he re-strategized and put together a political coalition and won an election to become president of Venezuela. And basically, from that point forward, every subsequent decision he made was to further entrench himself and make sure he could never be voted out of office.
Well, and just to clarify, his political party was called the United Socialist Party.
Exactly. So overtly Marxist, very, very far left wing. But in the mid to late 2000s, Venezuela's economy was not yet suffering under the full repercussions of the policies he had implemented. They were coasting on oil wealth. Gas prices were up, oil prices were high, and they were basically just extracting this resource that they've been endowed with out of the ground and using it to subsidize all these little socialist pet projects and schemes of Hugo Chavez. And in 2007, he had this idea, he called it the Bank of the South. And what he was trying to do was to get a coalition of other Marxist leaders in South America to break away from the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. And they got together and they signed an agreement, and they were going to use Venezuela's oil wealth to basically subsidize leftism under the name of economic development and ensure that none of these dictator types ever went away. So you had Evo Morales in Bolivia on board, Lula da Silva, who's unfortunately back in Brazil in power, but was also one of these signatories. And then you had the Kirchner regime in Argentina, basically the Peronists that Javier Milei booted out of power by defeating them in an election. But it's all the left-wing cronies of Latin America got together in Caracas. They signed this agreement to have this breakaway bank from the World Bank and IMF. And they get Nobel laureate economist from the United States by the name of Joseph Stiglitz to come down there and give like his stamp of approval to this thing.
He's pretty famous.
Yeah, very famous economist on the left. He served in the Clinton administration. He himself was the former head economist of the World Bank. So him giving the stamp of approval to Hugo Chavez's scheme is seen as a big thing. It legitimizes it in the eyes of the international press. And it legitimizes the Chavez regime in the eyes of certainly people on the left. They're like, well,
and now the Maduro regime.
So,
exactly.
So ironically, what is Stiglitz doing now? Stiglitz is going around the world, or around the United States, touting his finding that classical liberalism and free markets lead to dictatorships and authoritarianism. Here's a guy who put his stamp on an authoritarian scheme and a country, particularly Venezuela.
He didn't just praise Venezuela. He actively colluded with the Hugo Chavez government, went down there on a junket, appeared on TV with the guy praising this thing. And yet he's claiming that Milton Friedman, the long-deceased Milton Friedman, and Friedrich Hayek are responsible because of neoliberalism for a rise of authoritarian government. So it's a complete hypocrisy. He has this new book out making this claim, and he's completely silent on his own direct complicity in the Hugo Chavez regime that has bred direct authoritarianism under his successor, Nicolas Maduro, today.
And to overcome his election loss, Maduro is resorting to even more draconian measures, it seems to me, including dramatic restrictions on the press and social media communications.
It's interesting also because the mass movement involving millions of people who oppose Maduro. Remember, the anti-Maduro candidate won two-thirds of the vote.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very clear. We have the evidence.
Yes.
And so, but the leader of it, the opposition leader, is a classical liberal. She calls herself a populistic liberal, meaning that she favors freedom, economic as well as political.
Machado.
Yes. Yeah.
Is she in prison yet?
She's sometimes analogized to Margaret Thatcher as the Iron Lady of Venezuela.
Is she in prison yet?
No, she is not.
Oh, thank goodness.
But she's been in hiding, and it seems like the Maduro regime is out to get her. They've arrested, I think, over almost 3,000 people, though, the opposition, basically sending armed thugs around. And now they're the latest story I read, they're painting X's on the doors of people who are perceived to have voted for the wrong candidate to basically target them for terrorism.
Wow.
This is they're reaching
degradation of a Soviet-style regime.
It is.
They're reaching farther down. So previous persecutions have tended to be of leaders. I mean, sometimes they're local leaders, but leaders. Now, if you have something adverse to the regime on your cell phone, or if there's reason to believe you voted against Maduro, they will put you in jail or beat you up.
And of course, dissent is the huge threat. And in this era, unlike previous eras, there's a whole new set of dissent tools and social media and so forth, which apparently he's cutting off access to social media too, lest people talk to one another and disagree with him.
Cut off access to social media. And he's also redirecting people to use these government apps that used to be like reporting like a power outage or a utility break to now spy on your neighbor.
Right. There's so snitch apps.
Yeah, snitch apps, basically. And you want all of that controlled by the government, just like the state media. He squeezed out private media and taken over media made it essentially a television channels and newspapers of the state regime that are all there to do propaganda to prop him up. So it's just a classic descent into totalitarian atrocity. So I think there's, unfortunately, a very dark period of Venezuelan future ahead if right. he remains in power much longer.
What's pretty interesting is that there is widespread, you know, revulsion against his cutting down on freedom of speech and social media access and so forth. And yet at the same time, in Europe and the European Union seems to be proposing new restrictions on social media communication and so forth in the name of, well, the good old fighting disinformation.
Right.
It's not right. as bad as the Maduro thing, but isn't it kind of the same genre of thing?
It is. And this came particularly to the fore. It was highlighted by the fact that one of the administrators, one of the commissioners that deals with this in the European Union, wrote a letter to Elon Musk shortly before Musk was due to interview Donald Trump, saying, "Don't you dare do this. Whatever Trump will tell things that are untrue, Trump will exaggerate, Trump will be disruptive, Trump will lead to riots by something that he says. And therefore, we condemn you." And I believe Trump, of course, Trump went ahead and did the interview. Musk did it with him. And Musk also replied to this letter with an expletive.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, well, this is, you see the strategy here, the power play they're doing. These are people that claim to be government officials of the European Union, but they're trying to project their regulations internally onto other parts of the world. They're saying this interview that's occurring in the United States, that's about the United States election. And we see this theme playing out over and over again. So the EU is doing it. There's another case going on right now. There's a kind of this renegade judge in Brazil that has started issuing edicts to Twitter and or X, I guess it is now called, and other social media companies to reveal information about their users. But the users are located in Argentina or the users are located in the United States. So it'd be like a violation of U.S. law to give this information to the Brazilian government. And basically, Elon Musk and X have decided, hey, we're pulling out of this country. We're closing our office down there.
Facebook has been threatened as well. It's not just X. And Musk has been doing a good job of exposing this runaway judge who, you know, periodically will issue lists of who should be denied access to various platforms. Another fascinating thing is in Sao Paulo, the biggest newspaper has been running a series of articles by Glenn Greenwald.
Right.
And
right.
Glenn Greenwald has gotten access to the internal communications of this judge and showing how he's instructing the authorities to gin up problems that so that he can target certain providers, certain people that are posting on these platforms and deny them access. So it's a really fascinating thing that's going on. I have to give Musk a lot. I mean, I don't want to give Musk credit for being right on everything or something like that. But when it comes to free speech, the guy is a real fighter.
Yep. Yeah.
And there is a kind of very valid slippery slope argument. I mean, the EU is not turning into Venezuela, and yet, as they begin to adopt these kind of things with popular support, I don't see any logical stopping point.
Right. And it's fostering new types of legislation. So I think there are some bills that are coming up in Germany that are going to authorize more police action on social media posts, even though it's outside of the EU, but the United Kingdom. They've had this crackdown on what they call hate speech online, and that this is stuff that a lot of it's truly reprehensible. It's truly racist, vile speech, but it's not violent. It's something we should condemn. But they're saying, "Oh, well, you said some hate speech online. Now we're going to sentence you to a year in jail," which kind of defeats the whole purpose of having free speech protections. Is you know, First Amendment rights in the United States and free speech abroad. The premise here is that obnoxious, terrible speech is nonetheless tolerated under that out of the values of a free and open society. It's not something we criminalize, because if we start criminalizing that, it is a slippery slope into regulating other types of speech that are valid.
So we see this going on in England very prominently. The Labour Party is pushing this because they're pointing to the riots that have been taking place. Riots, I guess, triggered by fears of immigrants. But anyway, they're trying to control speech. Again, it's in the name of stopping hate and stopping disinformation. And I would add that Tim Walz has also been part of
this,
saying that hate speech is not free speech. Actually, under the Constitution, it is. And the Democrats in general, and I say there's a certain number of, I think of some Republican senators who also want to have government control of disinformation. So this is a case where there are people, some of them quite prominent in both parties, wanting to have some kind of supervisor of speech and postings and information.
Yep. Think back to the COVID era. Misinformation was targeted by the government, and Tim Walz was one of the worst governors on this margin. But imagine this, if your speech has to go through an approval process that's governed by Anthony Fauci.
Well,
that's basically what they
want. Don't despair, people. I saw an article on the front page of the business section of the New York Times announcing FBI, again, returning to give advice to media companies about what they should or shouldn't be posting.
I saw that too. Yeah, pretty stunning. But, you know, people get very muddled about this, because what we're saying is that there is no place for the government, especially the federal government, to be controlling what people say, penalizing what they say, pre-censoring and so forth. There's no place for that. But that doesn't mean that persons and communities and families and private institutions can't condemn speech that they consider hateful. Free speech means not only free speech, but it also means the freedom for persons and communities and private institutions to freely take their own positions and enforce them with regard to their own private, voluntary, in some case, educational communities. So you can simultaneously defend free speech and defend people's right to condemn what they regard as hateful speech.
Yeah. Let truth and error collide, and truth will emerge for the better.
It will, absolutely, right. And what we're really concerned about here, and what is the most dangerous...
It's too bad that Milton didn't believe in...
Unfortunately, his rhetoric was better than his action.
Yes. Catholics, Quakers, a few
we're
other
we're talking people. About John Milton, not Milton Friedman.
I'm talking about John Milton. And he believed it. He believed in free speech for Bible-believing Protestants.
Yes.
But not Catholics, Quakers, antinomians, atheists, and other riffraff.
Yeah, and nowadays,
but maybe Moors, maybe Muslims,
maybe Moors, right? Well, they gradually expanded that over the next two centuries, and this again is taking place in England.
Right. Yeah.
Unfortunately, what we're seeing is now England's turning in the other direction. It's like the pendulum's swinging back.
But there are people. There's a lot of people fighting back in England, saying that this government is going too far.
Yeah. Exactly. Hey. So in the remaining minutes here, just a couple of things back in the U.S. setting that I'm catching my attention. As the school starts up again on college campuses and so forth, there's going to be a resurgence of these pro-Hamas protests, encampments and so forth. There was this fascinating federal judge decision regarding UCLA, which apparently is at fault for having allowed students to create a no-go zone for Jews on their campus. And the court found that the university was itself at fault for fostering and enabling this refusal to allow Jewish students into certain parts of campus. Can either of you describe briefly this ruling and what it means?
Well, it's back to the point about accessing buildings and dormitories and classes on campus. This needs to be maintained for all students. And what we saw with a lot of the protest encampments both UCLA and other places like Columbia that were all over the news last semester, is they're not just out there on the street corners holding signs and engaging in free speech. That would be their right if they did. What they're actually doing is they're declaring zones of campus off limits or trying to occupy the quad, occupy buildings. That's where it crosses the line over from speech into actual religious persecution. And we all saw the videos of Jewish students just trying to walk to class and being blocked or hounded by these mobs of protesters in very physical ways. And that's basically what the judge is saying. UCLA permitted this to happen. That's illegal. That's unconstitutional because it's a public institution.
It was shocking, really. Shocking that the university sort of not only tolerated it, but seemed to implicitly affirm it by the what did and didn't do. And this is what the court has taken exception to. Of course, this coincides now with the resignation of the third Ivy League president, Minush Shafiq, which I'm sure you've been following that, Phil. Yep. This is kind of like a delayed reaction from how she mishandled things previously regarding the pro-Hamas protesters. Is that right?
Right. She kind of went into almost like a hiding phase at the end of last semester, waited for the students to go home over the summer and thought that it would die down. And now here the new semester is upon us, and it sounds like it's all reviving again. And what did she do? Well, she submitted her resignation. And it seems basically that she was kind of coerced into that because the university took a huge reputational hit from the way that she mismanaged it before.
Yeah, pretty fast. At least she wasn't apparently found guilty of plagiarism that right. I have heard of.
Other things, yeah.
Unlike others. So we're kind of coming for a landing here. Let's get back to our initial idea, our initial theme, which was the economic illiteracy of these presidential candidates. Here's my thought, and I wanted to see if your reaction, what your reaction to it would be. Both Trump and Harris seem to be either economically illiterate and or they are ready to engage in economically illiterate rhetoric to try and gain favor with groups of voters and so forth, maybe knowing that it can't be done, the price control thing can't be done. Is there reason to hope that if either of them gets elected, whichever of them gets elected, that their economic foolishness won't really be translated into public policy because reality will set in and they'll have good advisors? Or am I naively hopeful?
Well, I will say one thing. Many of the proposals, particularly Kamala Harris's, require legislation.
Yes.
They are not something that the president, whoever the president is, can just snap his or her finger and say, I'm issuing an executive edict, and this is how it's going to be. So a few of them can be done by that, but they Congress is very divided right now. We don't know what the new Congress exactly is going to be, but it's unlikely that it will be, overwhelmingly for one side or another. I think it's just as the country is divided, Congress is also going to be divided. And so it's going to be tough to put, the Democrats during the Biden administration did a few important things by one vote. But
Harris cast that vote.
It's good. Harris cast
the tax on tips and the IRS enforcement. She cast the tie-breaking vote.
Did.
She's reneged and going in the other direction and claiming her idea to remove that tax.
I'm confused.
Well, how they say, how do you tell if a politician is lying? You look, see if his lips are moving. But anyway, it's harsh. There are some honest politicians, and I'm being
so you're saying, Bill, that the legislative realities of a divided Congress will
make it difficult to do some of the big things that she's calling.
Or even things that Trump may be doing. What do you think, Phil?
That's true also.
Are there realities that are going to set in to block either of their economic foolishness from being enacted?
So I hope there are, and I hope that is, I think the best outcome either way is divided government. But at the same time, where I'm really concerned are about the appointments to key economic agencies. Who does Trump pick or who does Harris pick for the Treasury Department, the U.S. Trade Representative, for the Council of Economic Advisors? And in previous iterations of the Trump administration, and if you go back to the Obama administration, Even though they picked people that were kind of on the left or kind of on the right, they were well within the economic mainstream. I'm less optimistic that's going to be the case this time around. I do think and fear that Harris opens the door to modern monetary theory
people. Right.
Mm-hmm. I think and fear that Trump opens the door and puts someone like Robert Lighthizer in the Treasury Department that
right.
would just mm-hmm. use it to foster protectionism. So that's the real risk here, and that's where I think we need congressional oversight of exercising the confirmation process. That might be the backstop of getting a crackpot on either the far left or the far right into a key economic position, which could be pretty disastrous.
In
so I would say also, though, when I was offering my hopeful thought that Congress might block things, in the case of tariffs and the level of tariffs, the president is given by statute a lot of discretion. And so, of course, it would be nice if Congress would take that back. Not that they would exercise it wisely, but still, it seems too extravagant to put such discretionary power in the hands of one person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so true. Well, in a way, what you're saying, Phil, about potentially the appointment of magical monetary thinking and so forth into putting advocates of those ideas into place, you're kind of telling us that ideas have consequences. So what goes on in the faculty lounges eventually works its way to presidential appointments, it's worth paying attention to these problems, which is why we're so grateful to have you doing your work, Phil Magnus. And I would invite our friends around the country and around the world, visit our website, independent.org, check out some of the things that Philip Magnus has written on these topics and things that Bill Evers has done as well on our website. We have a lot of information for you that we think will counteract some of the really bad ideas that are out there in the world. We're trying to do our little bit on today's conversation, but there's more for you on independent.org. Final word from Bill Evers and then from Phil Magnus.
I have to say that the politicians are engaged in an orgy of bad thinking.
I'll say. That's for sure. Final word from Phil.
Absolutely. It's a race to the economic bottom. I think the unfortunate implication of that is no matter who wins the election, we're all going to lose on some margin.
Yeah. Sad to say. Okay. Well, we're doing our best here, and we invite our friends to keep in touch with us. Thanks for joining us for Independent Outlook. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.